Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to the SMRT MR Safety Week 2021 podcast. I want to thank Nancy Balak for helping us set this up and Vera Kimbrell, who is with me today. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning, Bill.
Vera helped organize all this stuff. We couldn't have done it without them. With us this morning is Leslie Colston, who is from Kansas City, Kansas. And Leslie, good morning. We're glad to have you with us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
That's good to be anywhere nowadays. We're going to be, or Leslie particularly, is going to be talking about pain pumps, and in particular, the SynchroMed 2 model with regard to conditions of use. So Leslie, tell us a little bit about this device and how you went about getting the research on it.
So the SynchroMed 2 pain pump is used to deliver medications, specifically pain medicines for patients who are kind of in chronic need. When we get the notification that the patient has this particular pump, there's a couple of sources that we tend to use to research them. For kind of a generic information, you can look at the MRI safety website that Dr. Shellock has. It gives you some very basic information, whether it's conditional, safe, or unsafe. Our facility, we actually do have access to MAG Resource. So that is kind of our go-to. It's a fantastic resource, gives you direct links to the manufacturer's website. From there, you can kind of look into the specific implant requirements before deciding whether or not we can scan the patient.
Is let me just ask this: is pain pump, or do you have a pain pump? Is that on a scheduling questionnaire? In other words, when someone calls to schedule a study, are they asked at that time, or is the patient called by MRI people ahead of them showing up to ask if they have something like this?
A little bit of both. So when patients are scheduled for their procedures, they are asked some fairly generic, do you have implants? And then if the answer is yes, our scheduling department, if it's an outpatient, will reach out to us and kind of let us know. Then we can call the patient directly. We also do pre-screening prior to a patient's appointment. So we're calling, we do reminder calls for appointment times. And if the patient is available, we will run through the questions at that time as well. Inpatients, obviously, they're screened ahead of time before they come down.
So Leslie, for pain pumps, do you, I know that some of the conditions involve in getting an x-ray or, you know, or perhaps calling the manufacturer. There are a few different pain pumps and a few different types of pre-scan conditions. So do you have the patients come in a little early so that you can investigate these?
Sometimes, kind of depend, especially if the patient is unclear as to what they have or if they don't have their implant card handy. Sometimes we will get x-rays to kind of confirm what we're really looking at. And then, of course, with some of the requirements, and I believe the SynchroMed is one where, and correct me if I'm wrong, that is one where the positioning of it can make a difference.
Go ahead. So the particular orientation to B0 will restrict or will basically cause problems with its operation. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Has to be, if it's, I don't have that condition right in front of me. I believe if it's 90 degrees to B0, then it's not recommended.
I think that's correct. And the problem that we always had when we got these devices is the techs were really uncomfortable deciding that for themselves. So, you know, I think another one of the conditions that says get an x-ray, or you can like feel for the implant on the patient to see if the technologists were always like, I don't know. that's always just a little hard to do. They were always more comfortable when we could get an x-ray and a radiologist could say that the device was okay. Well, for this one in particular seems a little, a little more involved than some of the other devices that we scan.
Mm-hmm. Well, does this one, this device particularly require that the pump be emptied before the scan?
This one does not require that. It can remain filled.
I think this is, and this is, I think, is a very important point for people listening to this. This is why it's extremely important that you identify the device specifically and that you look at the conditions of use specifically for this device, because there are other pain pumps who that clearly state that it has to be emptied. And I know for a fact that one of the other manufacturers, there is a documented death, overdose, following a particular pump being placed in an MRI that wasn't emptied except when it went into MRI, and then it did empty. And that's what created the overdose.
Yeah.
Leslie, do you want to just kind of go over some of the MRI conditions on this particular pump, and, you know, and maybe talk through how you would decide? Do you have multiple scanners at your site?
Yes, we do.
So
we're fortunate. We have several.
Yeah. I had the same fortunate situation at one of the sites that I worked at, but not all sites are. So some sites, have to decide or aren't able to scan some devices that, that aren't 3T safe. Although it looks like from these conditions that this one can do 1.5 or 3T. So you want to just go through the conditions and just let me know, just kind of talk through how you would decide whether or not this implant is okay at your particular site.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first one, fairly simple. This one actually can be scanned on 1.5 or 3 Tesla. So that's good. Majority of sites are going to at least have your 1.5. It specifically requests a horizontal closed bore. So that's going to be your conventional MRI, not an open vertical field. So for sites that have only the vertical field magnets, it would not fit that condition.
Let me interrupt right here for this one, if you don't mind, because this is I just made a note of this. Even though the field strength issues, if it's okay, if it's not a ferrous issue at 3T and it's not at 1.5, it wouldn't be on a vertical field, say 1.2, for example. It would not be a ferrous issue, but the problem is the direction of the field relative to the device. And this is where that 90 degrees to be zero comes into play. So this is why it's important. If you're going to go off label, you got to really understand what the conditions of use are referring to. And I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's a really good example of when off-label in the case of a vertical field would be very problematic.
Yes, no, I agree. And I'm glad you put that clarification in there, because that is very, very true. The next one is going to be the maximum spatial gradient. This one requires 19 Tesla per minute or 1900 Gauss per centimeter. If people have access to their gradient field maps, that's where you're going to look for this number. I'm terrible at explaining this, but.
This one in particular, 1900 Gauss per centimeter or 19 Tesla.
Fairly generous.
It's very, very high because nobody's really going to have a spatial gradient of that value. It's going to be somewhere around 700, 900, right at the mouth of the bore. But anytime you see something this high, what you're looking at is an extrapolated spatial gradient, which means they tested it and then extrapolated the values up to a theoretical fail point. So, bottom line, when you see something this high, have at it. I mean, you don't even have
you're
to.
You're good. Yeah.
You're good to go.
Yeah. Well, I think we usually get a little more nervous when it's around the 700 mark. That's when you really start looking, but for sure.
Well, and what I always told techs when they came to me with conditions that were a little low, like in the 700 or 800s, remember that the maximum spatial gradient is a point, not a sphere.
Right.
So, you to, you know, to get to the maximum spatial gradient, you have to kind of walk up to it and, you know, lay on it.
Right.
But it doesn't.
Right. You're going to go past it. You know, you're going to wave at it as you go by.
Yeah. It's kind of like crossing a river, right? You're not in the river. You're crossing it, you know, on a bridge, on a safe bridge.
Yes.
So as long as you're in, you know, on the table, you know, I know that sometimes our patients can, you know, be a little large and they may not be where we, you know, where we'd like them to be. And unless the implant is in the arm or in the leg or, you know, someplace that's, you know, that's kind of external to the body, then we're in pretty good shape. But it sounds like for this particular implant, you know, our field strength is good for, you know, for you. You've got a 1.5 T and a 3T cylindrical bore. It says you can use any coil. So, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of RF coil we use. So that's pretty easy. And then they set the maximum spatial gradient really super high. So far we're in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
So what about the next one, Leslie, the 200 Tesla per meter per second?
Yeah. So that's your maximum gradient slew rate. And I think this particular condition, most technologists don't know this number. It's one of those numbers that when they go to sell you a magnet, they talk about and they kind of brag about their slew rate. And I will admit, I think this is a pretty high one as well. Again, so correct me if I'm wrong.
It's a normal one. Most magnets are this.
Right. Yeah. Let me throw something out at this one. This was an interesting one that came up in a thing we were doing some weeks ago with the radiologist who said, how do I know I don't exceed this slew rate? Because it doesn't report it. You know, how do I know I don't exceed it? Here's a very interesting way to know it. Remember that the actual slew rate on the gradient will increase when you do things that stress the gradient, which is small fields of view, thin slices primarily. So, you know, because we use normal fields of view, you know, 300, 400 millimeters, you know, depending on what we're doing, you know, 280, something like that. And your slice thickness is, you know, 3-4 millimeters, you never reach that slew rate. We did a study with one of the device manufacturers, and Manny Canal had actually participated in developing this protocol. So the purpose was to stress out the gradients or expose the device to maximum slew rate. It was a pacemaker, if I'm not mistaken. And you would center on the brain, and then you would do a diffusion with the absolute smallest field of view you could do, like 12 centimeters, and the absolute thinnest slice thickness, like 2. The images look like crap, obviously. But basically what I'm saying is when you do a normal field of view and slice thickness, there is no way you're at the maximum slew rate of the scanner. It just doesn't happen.
It just can't happen.
Yeah, so
that's a good explanation. I kind of wish they would explain that more. Because like I said, it's one of those things they you know, I've been in on some of those sales conversations and they talk about it, and it's, you know, kind of a big deal, and then nobody talks about it again.
Right, it's kind of like
really explain like how it works.
Yeah, here's your slew rate. Oh, you want to use it? Well, if you use it, you'll never get to it. That's a slew rate that, you know, that occurs when you're not scanning something for diagnostic purposes, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but go ahead. That's something that does come up. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, that's just a number that you can't scan at that slew rate because it wouldn't be diagnostic.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you wouldn't want to scan it even if you could.
And I think that for most magnets, unless you pay extra for like extra, you know, fancy gradients, there aren't many magnets out there that are higher than 200. When I worked in Boston, we had two Siemens 3T performance gradients magnets, and they were 250. Like Bill said, there's no way to know when you're where you are But, you know, they did assure us that we would have to really, really, really do something special.
something very Dawn diagnostic.
Yeah, to get to that number. So, you know, so I think that that's why a lot of the implant manufacturers, you know, test to 200 or, you know, or just put 200 in
they,
there.
Yeah, what they do is just put whatever the specs of the system are that they tested it on. I mean, because that's all it can
do. I kind of wondered about that. Yeah.
It is. It's just whatever the system they tested it on. Okay, so what's your maximum? And then that's what goes into the conditions that's of use.
Yeah. All right. So we've covered everything except the next one says RF field intensity. And it says first level controlled operating mode. So what does that mean for you, Leslie?
So for us, that means, so depending on the system that you're on, you know, the default's either going to be a normal operating mode or this first level. First level basically allows you to increase like your maximum SAR, rather than a normal operating mode. And again, depending on the system you're using, like the newer GE systems, which we have one, their default is first level. Which is fine. I mean, that could be a whole other conversation about the differences between normal mode and first level. But basically for me, that tells me that I'm going to be okay scanning this patient. I'm really not going to have SAR requirements. I don't have to really pay much attention to B1 RMS. I know that that's a new thing that people are learning about and having to watch, because that first level increases all those numbers. So I can basically scan this thing all day.
Right. All you got to do is pick normal operating mode, which is going to limit you to 2 watts per kilogram. So even though a system may default, and GE's default depends on how somebody built the protocol. If you go to the front, when you first put the patient in, you have the option to pick normal or first level, and just picking normal will keep you in that. Alan, by the way, that's another thing about if you pick normal operating mode, and that's also for gradients as well, because typically that's for both, then you're definitely not going to hit 200 Tesla per meter per second if you pick normal operating mode. So that kind of keeps you in the limits very easily there.
So active. Oh, this is a good one. Oh, this is a really good one. I love this one. Active scan time. The risk of heating increases for active torso scanning durations over 30 minutes. So
does it have a wait time? Does it, you know, in other words, if you have to scan over 30 minutes?
No, it doesn't. Well, it does talk about, here's what it says. Presence of the pump can potentially cause an increase of local temperatures in tissues near the pump. Active torso scanning durations exceeding 30 minutes increase the risk of heating. If the patient indicates discomfort at any time during an MRI, the MRI procedure should be stopped or the intensity of the scan sequence should be reduced. So it doesn't really give you any parameters. It basically says that you've got some flexibility, and if the patient experiences any symptoms, you should, you know, not do that. I think, so conditions like this make techs really nervous. They're kind of now on their own to, you know, to do whatever that they think is the right thing. And, you know, everybody thinks a little bit differently about what the right thing is. So Leslie, how do you guys handle this?
We really allow the patient to let us know. It's one of those conditions that, since it is not a hard, fast rule, you know, there's not a restriction on, you know, it has to be less than 30 minutes. We do tend to just, we'll go ahead and scan. We'll let the patient obviously let us know, like you said, if they have any heating, any pain in the area. It's just one to kind of be aware of and just make sure the patient's alert and oriented enough to tell you how they're feeling as the scan progresses, especially on the longer multiple exams. But yeah, without a, you know, when you read some conditions and they say, you know, 15 minutes of continuous scanning, something like that, we're going to be a lot more diligent about paying attention to our timing. Yeah, like this, it's not as critical.
Yeah, typically when you see the 15 minutes, that's usually per sequence. And right in 30 minutes is kind of what you'll see with a lot of neurostimulators actually as well. Some of them have a wait time of some 5 minutes, some 60 minutes. But this sounds just like it's a little CYA from an attorney language or something, you know, just telling, because it is true. I mean, you're going to get increased temperatures around a piece of metal, and that's just something you're going to have to, you always have to watch.
For sure. For sure.
Well, I just was going to say that these patients, I don't know how they are at your facility, but a lot of these patients have chronic pain and you're doing more than one exam. You might be doing a double study or even a triple study. You were limited to 30 minutes of scan time, you wouldn't be able to finish your study. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, is there any other one there, condition of use, or is that pretty much?
Yeah.
Well, I think those are the last
one. The very last, I think this is what Bill was asking about, if there were any other conditions to follow. The last one is just the peripheral nerve stimulation. I think that's one that exists with every MRI. It's not restricted to just this implant. So, and again, that's just communication with the patient and letting us know how they feel as they go through.
Yeah, absolutely. The presence of an implant has no bearing on peripheral nerve stimulation. I don't know where the crap that came from.
I don't even know why they put that in there, to be honest.
Well, knows? I think because, because it's one of the side effects, I guess you could say, of MRI, is that we could potentially cause peripheral nerve stimulation. So they put it in there.
Yeah.
And peripheral nerve stimulation is one of the things that happen, but it's sometimes a little bit random, and you never know which patient's going to have it and which patient isn't. Yeah. So I think that the pre-scan conditions and then the scanning conditions for this implant don't seem too difficult for most sites. The problem that I've always seen with this particular implant is actually what needs to happen after the scan. So Leslie, how do you guys handle the post MRI conditions for this device?
Yeah. So the Synchromed is kind of unique in this way, to where, if people aren't familiar with this particular pain pump. So there's no requirement to turn the device off prior to scanning. So when you take the patient into the scan room, it's going to stall. It does a motor stall. Not harmful to the patient, as long as they can be without the medicine for a while. And I think that's an interesting point to make, or an important point to make, is to make sure that the patient can tolerate being without that continuous delivery of medicine for however long your scan is, because that'll make a difference on their tolerance level of the scan. So with the assumption that they can be without it for 30 minutes or an hour, once they walk into the magnet room, that is going to stall. So they will no longer be getting the medicine. When the scan is finished, you have to manually turn this device back on. Synchromed will tell you, Medtronic will tell you, you need to wait really 20 minutes or so to check it. And sometimes the device will turn itself back on after a certain amount of time. Otherwise, regardless, you have to check it. At our facility, we have a device Medtronic has given us where we can actually check that the motor has turned back on. I know that's not the case for many, many sites. So in a situation where you don't have the device to turn it back on, a little interrogation device, they would actually have to reach out to a Medtronic rep and have them come back and check and make sure that that device is turned back on to the settings that was set to prior. We will do, depending on outpatient or inpatient, if we will do a check within just a few minutes of the scan being completed. A lot of times this device will turn back on within like 5 minutes. You don't have to wait 20 minutes to check it. they just tell you to allow that amount of time in case it doesn't turn back on. I think if that's making sense, and I'm not talking in
circles. We had the same thing, Leslie, where I worked in, when I was in Boston, we had the same thing. And kind of the rule of thumb that the device reps told us is that sometimes it would take the amount of time that the patient was in the magnet to turn back on. So if you were scanning the patient for 15 or 20 minutes for like a routine lumbar spine, then it could come back on pretty quickly. But if you're doing a triple study and they had been in the magnet for an hour and a half, then it may take some time to turn back on. And like you, we had the interrogation device that was hooked up to our PAC system, and it worked beautifully. But before that, and I think for a lot of other sites, they're depending on someone from the pain clinic to come and interrogate them for them. And they don't want to come in 10 or 15 minutes and then it not be on and come back. And, so they would tend to be, you know, a little bit delayed. And sometimes you had to keep the patient at your site for a little while and they weren't super happy. You know, that can be a little bit of a problem. But the thing that Bill and I talked about a little bit before you got on, Leslie, was that these are some pretty serious drugs. So the things that are in these pain pumps are, you know, are like real life drugs. And the patients, you know, can experience withdrawal if the pump doesn't come on, and they can have some significant side effects from that. So this is kind of an important condition that this device is actually on before they leave and operating correctly before they leave the site. So I think that that techs that are, you know, that are scanning these patients need to be aware of that you know, these aren't the patients that you can just kind of like, you know, shuffle on to the dressing room and, you know, and send them on their way. You know, you really do need to take this last kind of important step.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, Leslie, any take-home points that you'd like to bring up about this device that you've, you know, that you've found helps you when you're researching it or helps you when you're scanning it or?
Not specifically. I think of all the implants that we have to deal with on a daily basis, this is probably one of the easier ones to deal with other than the, like you said, taking care after the scan is complete. You know, it's got a fairly broad condition to it. So, you know, at our site, you know, whenever we see one of these, you know, patients, of course, always get concerned because they have this device in them. And, you know, we're really quick to say, you're going to be fine. This is okay. it's a relatively easy device to deal with compared to others.
I think that's always great. Just make sure the patient's comfortable and that they're comfortable with you. And again, just one more thing before we get out of here. I just want to remind everybody that please understand we're referring to a specific device here, the Synchromed 2, Medtronic, and other similar devices have very different conditions of use. And so it's always critical to ensure that you're following the most updated conditions of use, because conditions do change, and also make sure that you're following conditions of use specific for that device. So with that, we'll go ahead and close this down, get out of here for this one. Leslie, we want to thank you so much for taking your time out of your day to spend with Vera and I to discuss this. And we want to thank you very much. Vera, I want to thank you as well. And again, a big thanks to Nancy Bellick, president of SMRT, helped set this up. Thank you all very much. We'll see you ladies
soon. Have a great day, everybody.
Take care. We're out of here. See ya. Goodbye.